great. Beauty.
Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Third Degree Burn. My name is Brian Hughes, and I am here with some good friends. Over here, we've got my old good friend, Tim Elliott. Say hi, Tim.
Hello.
And we got Nigel Spink over there in Japan. Hi, Nigel.
Hello there. Hi.
And sitting in for John Hyatt, we have Fred West. Is that right? West, everyone? Was it West or East? Is it North? I'm directionally impaired, so, you know.
Well, I'd like to say that he's not sitting in for John. He is part of the show. So he's actually been indoctrinated. So
I know, but he's using John's Skype connection. So I thought
that's true. We're seeing John's picture.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. So here we are. We're on our run through the books of Alpha Flight. And I don't know if you guys remember a number of years back in episode 65, we covered issue 6, Snowblind, the assistant editor's month book. And we had a lot to say about it, and yet we still have more to say. And, of course, we also have Nigel and Fred here to add their two cents. So, Tim, I think you've got the synopsis.
Indeed.
Before we get into that, though, let me ask you, Nigel, did you read it when it first came out?
Yes. Yes, I did. Yeah.
And I mean, was it – I mean – how are you getting your comic books in? Were you going into a shop?
Local comic book shop, yes. Yeah.
And Fred, how about you?
So I didn't read this part of Alpha Flight when it initially came out. I did go back after the hubbub caught on, basically, and buy them all at the Starship Excalibur shop in Providence, Rhode Island, where I was going to college. One. And then just a bender on it then. So,
Tim, how about you?
I did not. I read it not too long after, because I kind of discovered Alpha Flight when they were probably in the 20s. And then I went back and collected them all. So I read them within 2 or 3 years of them coming out.
Yeah, like this book came out in late 83. Mm. And I picked it up. I want to say in the summer of 87, after I'd gotten back from my first trip to Turkey, I went to Heroes Workshop and I picked up all the Burn stuff that I had missed in my first years of college and whatnot. And that I got the entire collection of Alpha Flight in that summer and read it at the late part of that summer.
And kind of surprising. Surprisingly, you find these a lot in dollar bins. They're not really scarce.
Well, no, they had a high print run. I mean, the first issue alone sold 500,000 copies. At the time, that was the highest selling comic of the day. I don't know if it matched the numbers of the 40s and 50s when you had not just kids but soldiers buying books. Or I don't know if they were ever keeping count of the sales numbers back then. I'd have to ask David. But that was the biggest selling book. Yeah.
Nowadays, if a comic sells 50 grand, that's a success.
That's huge.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, do you want to give us the rundown on it?
I will give you the lowdown. All right. As we said, we are continuing Alpha Flight. So this is kind of a repeat for some. I don't know about Brian. Some of my opinions may be the same that from our earlier episode, but we have. So I'm going to let most of the talking go to Fred and Nigel, who are brand new. So we get to find all brand new opinions on this. So as we said, this is Alpha Flight issue 6. And the reason why we're only covering one issue this episode is because we were doing them two at a time, but the next two issues are kind of a pair. And we would have to do either 3 issues or we'd have to split up a story. So we decided we'd just do issue 6 and then the other two fall in the line as 2 separate stories, two issues each. So, Alpha Flight number 6, titled Snowblind. Our writer, artist, letterer, and inker is John Byrne. Our colorist is Andy Yankus. Letterer is Michael Higgins. Our editor is Linda Grant. The guiding light, as he writes it, is Jim Shooter. This has a cover date of January 84 with an on-sale date of October or on sale at the end of October 18th, 1983. And it cost 60 cents here in the U.S. And I think it cost you 25p. Is that right, Nigel?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. As Brian has already noted, this is part of the Assistant Editors Month, which was kind of a, if you want to call it a gimmick, through that they were doing kind of experimental stories and things like that for the whole month because of the assistant editors were in charge. Other burn work at the time was FF262, which is the Trial of Reed Richards.
Starring John Byrne.
Yeah, exactly. And The Thing, number 7, but he was writer only. Ron Wilson was the artist on that one. All right. This has a backup story, so we're going to have the main story, then we'll have our backup origin story. All right, Snowblind. We open the office of the RCMP, Chief of Staff, District of McKenzie, Northwest Territories. Chief Inspector Hamilton is chewing out Anne McKenzie. He wants to know why she keeps disappearing from her post. We, of course, know that she is off and off saving Canada as a snowbird of Alpha Flight. She explains her predecessor authorized her absences. The inspector reminds her that he is in charge and orders an investigation into her actions and confines her to a cell. Corporal Doug Thompson tries to get Anne to explain where she goes so he can help her with the inspector, but she declines and settles into her new digs. Speaking of digs, 40 miles north, an oil rig drilling for oil, despite the warnings from the natives working on the area that it's an ancient and dangerous and sacred area. Suddenly, green energy erupts from the drill head. A swirling maelstrom destroys the drill and reforms itself into Kolomak, a giant shaggy figure with an Indian totem face, stands before the startled men. After 1,000 years, it is free. Anne senses a great disturbance in the forest, and another of the ancient beasts are loose. She transforms into Snowbird and crashes through the wall. Interlude. James Hudson, a.k.a. Guardian, leader of the Alpha Flight, streaks across the skies of Ottawa. He ponders Canadian government severing ties with the superhero team, and now they are on their own. He arrives home, but Heather is still at work. Pouring himself a glass of iced tea, he spots a letter from Rocks and Oil, America's biggest oil company. Why would they be reaching out to him? More to come with Rocks and later. In interlude, Snowbird intercepts Kolomak and commands him to halt. His ancient enemy, Tundra, has fallen. See Alpha Flight number 1. Kolomak recognizes Snowbird as the spirit of Hodiak and the power of Nelvana, another of his ancient foes. The beast unleashes his power with a living blizzard, for he is a living embodiment of winter. Snowbird is caught in a total whiteout. She transforms into a half-ton polar bear and attacks. Two combatants crash through the trees and boulders. Suddenly the ground is gone, nothing but empty air. Snowbird changes into a snow owl and circles the creature as the storm rages. Fearing she will give in to the animal's nature, Snowbird resumes her human form and collapses into the snow. She is now snowblind. Cannot assume the shape of a beast through the snow, like a bat. Kolomak taunts her. He has the power of the old gods, but will it be enough to defeat him? She has the power of the old gods, but will it be enough to defeat him? She attacks the ancient beast in her human form and staggers him, but he counters with a swarm of ice daggers that slash her skin. She taunts him. His powers are weak, old man. He cannot defeat her. The Ancient One grows angry and unleashes his full power against the hero. The storm rips at the base of the cliff, and with the earth-shattering rumble, Kolomak is buried under tons of rock and snow. Once again, he is imprisoned in his ancient foe, Tundra. Storm clears, and our hero is greeted by the man from the drilling rig. She suggests they seal the slide with concrete so the beast can never rise again. She takes to the air, worrying if the ancient barriers continue to weaken, how many other beasts will emerge? The end. All right. And our backup story, The Old Ways. We open on Dr. Michael Tu Youngman, a.k.a. Shaman of Alpha Flight, sitting on a bluff overlooking a snowy lake near Banff, Alberta. He treks back to his one-room cabin of the last 10 years and reflects on his life. Flashback. He was called the best physician in Canada, but with all his powers, he could not save his wife. Her death cost him the love of his daughter, full of grief and rage. Same day, his grandfather passed. A medicine man to Michael's tribe. He received a strange gift and was told not to open it until it was time. Flash forward. Michael never believed in the mystic part of his heritage. He was a man of science, but now he hears another calling. He unwraps the gift and a visage by a force ghost, the ghost of his grandfather. Michael is afraid he has gone mad, but Papa Ghost tells him to look at the table and see the skull of his grandfather resting on a leather medicine bag. ghost tells him he must accept the old ways. He must reach into the bag and take out a handful of pine needles. Michael pulls out nothing. His doubt has caused him to fail. His grandfather warns him to never look into the bag. Let the lessons begin. Like Jor-El and Yoda, Michael is to unlearn what he has learned, and he begins trained in the ancient ways. He trains his body and learns to look with new eyes. Day comes when he must reach into the bag again, but his grandfather warns him that doubt can cost him dearly. He clears his mind and reaches in and pulls out a handful of pine needles. This does not go unnoticed. 3,000 miles away, Dr. Strange proclaims, Michael T. Youngman will make a great shaman. The end.
Well done. Well
done. Thank you. I always stumble. As many of these as I've read, I always stumble over reading these synopses.
There was one point where I had a question. Was Kolomak saying that he was the spirit of Hodiak and the power of Nirvana? Wasn't he saying that about her?
That's her. And I misread that, and that's my flub.
Okay, just making sure. And I found it interesting, you know, looking at this one with newer eyes, that the assistant editor's month tag is actually on the first page and not on the front page, not on the front.
Yeah, it's not on the cover.
Yeah.
And apparently Byrne had requested that.
I can see why. It would interfere with that old white, that white
spoil,
cover.
Spoil the white cover.
Yep. Well, what do you guys think? Nigel, what do you think about this one?
Okay. First of all, after what you were saying earlier about how when you guys first read it, then I realized that, of the ones of us that are here, I'm the only one who kind of read it as it first came out. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. I think so, yeah.
Yep. So maybe the effects of Assistant Editor's Month was like a larger effect on me than maybe you guys, because you're reading it as an old comic, which is already gone by however many years it was. And so it's like, this is what happened and you can't do anything about it. So I wanted to start off by sort of just mentioning about Assistant Editor's Month before I go on to the actual story in this comic. Because I say, I was aware that Assistant Editor's Month was coming up, because they were always talking about it at the comic shop and everything. And I was a bit, because I was ready for all the possible silliness, weirdness, etc. that you might get. And I had a feel, well, actually, I had a feeling that maybe Assistant Editor's Month might have been a bit inconvenient to John Byrne. Knowing what he's like, you probably thought, oh Christ, do we have to do these stupid things? But and he was affected sort of more so than a lot of writers, because he was doing three books for this particular month. Not only was he doing the Alpha Flight writing and artwork, he was also doing Fantastic Four writing and artwork, and he was also, as Tim said, he was doing the thing, which he wrote. Usually he only wrote it, but also in the case of the issue here in Assistant Editor's Month, he did the backup feature. He actually drew it. It was connected to the main story, if you like, but as I say, he actually drew the backup part, the five extra pages connected to Assistant Editor's Month. So, he had to make some adjustments for this in all three of his comics. And I thought he did quite well here, because in the case of The Thing, it's just a little sort of funny story based on the story that you've already read earlier in the same comic, in which you get The Thing's take on the battle that he had with the villain of the week, which was somebody called Goody Two Shoes. He's complaining to Marvel, apparently, because they made the fight seem like it was a hard work for him in the main story. And in fact, Thing was saying that he took him out with just like a flick of his finger. So that was kind of humorous. And I don't know, I think somehow, because it's The Thing, humor seems to work with The Thing, you don't mind it, because The Thing was always kind of the the funny guy of the FF anyway, wasn't he? Right back in the Lee Kirby days. So you expect a bit of a funniness from him.
Well, you know, there was that that he wrote.
Yeah.
And he made a note in the margin that, you know, no matter what you do with the thing, there's no way to write him any funnier than he normally talks.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's what they actually called this small kind of second story that they tagged on to the end. It was called What the... Yeah. So that was that one. And then, as I say, with the FF, he tried to keep it serious, because if you remember the cover of FF262, it's a Gottfried Richards in chains, and there were all those faces in the background. And then in the little corner box where you'd normally have the heads, there were actually a little note from John Byrne, weren't they, saying, okay, I realise it's assistant editor's month, but let's not do anything too silly, guys, yeah? and apart from the fact that Byrne is in the story, it's pretty straightforward. And again, thinking back to the old FF, I mean, as early as FF10, it was established that FF had this connection with Marvel, whereby they would sell them their adventures to use as comic stories. So Byrne was just doing the same thing in his story. It's just that he was the latest writer. So he's the one who gets contacted by the Watcher and whisked off to attend the trial of Reed Richards. So that was good. I like the fact that they didn't spoil that in any way. And then this one, Snowblind. Again, at the time, I was a little disappointed because of the... I mean, I got the joke, if you like, about, you know, Snowblind. He's whipped up this snow blizzard, this beast, and so, you know, you can't see anything because it's all white. But I mean, you've got the dialogue, you've got the sound effects, you could still, you know, you've got the narration boxes too. So you could still follow the story, really. It's just that you couldn't see. But I mean, you could see as much as the oil rig workers could, who come up to Snowbird at the end and say, you know, oh, well, we couldn't really see much. But so you're like, you just had an oil rig worker's view of the battle. But at the same time, it still gives us plenty of an advance of the subplots. I mean, we get to see what's happening with the Guardian, and that's sort of setting the tone for what's to come. He's got that letter from Rocks and Oil, and he's wondering, yep, what's this all about. Mm-hmm. So he's advancing the plot there. We get to see this new beast, this Colomac, and so we know what he looks like. He looks a bit like, to me, he looks a bit apish. I don't know whether you thought the same thing.
Well, he later looks...
Where he's coming from with that. The hair gives him that thing.
Yeah, yeah.
That look. But when they focus on his face, boy, that is true.
Is that a totem?
You know, Inuit artwork kind of.
Yeah, right. Thing. Yeah, yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I think later he's drawn to look more like an ape or like a Sasquatch, something like that.
Ooh, right. So, yeah. Yeah.
I like his look in this better because it does look more kind of mystical and kind of almost like he is wearing a mask.
But... Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Sorry,
I'm just saying, while it may look like Inuit or other, Byrne had gone on record as saying that he didn't base any of these characters on anything from any Canadian lore or mythology.
Well, that's what's great about it, because it feels like he has, like he's done all this research and pulled these real stories or myths or things like that.
Yeah.
But he hasn't. He just made it all up. But it feels like it's part, it would be part of Canadian lore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And sorry, the other thing I was just going to add is, and the issue, the story in this issue itself, it's acting as a prelude to Snowbird's origin, which we're going to get as the backup feature in the next one next or issue. Two issues.
The next of them.
So it's still working as a good issue, you know, a good monthly issue that's moving everything forward, mm-hmm. even though he had to, you know, do something a little bit different because it was assistant editor's month. So mm-hmm. looking at it now, as, you know, just reading it again years later, the white pages, as it were, they don't really bother me that much. As I say, I would have liked to have seen the battle. And I wonder, I don't know if you know or not, Brian, did John Byrne ever actually draw anything?
He did light layouts, so he yeah. knew what was happening where. So yeah. Because yeah. the pages you see, each page has a layout of the blocks or the cubes or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
The panels.
Panels, yeah.
And so he just had to do that to make sure everything worked out fine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But he's never, ever shown it.
I would like to see those just to see what it looked like. Yeah. But apart from that, I think it's a good issue. And I mean, a lot of people at the time who probably were reading it as it came out, like I did, were a bit miffed about it, saying, oh, we've paid this money and, we're getting five pages of blank panels. But I mean, it was only, in Britain anyway, which is what I paid, it was only 25 pence, for God's sake. And I mean, the rest of the art, the rest of the artwork that we do see, it's worth the admission, if you like, as it is, you know, even without those five pages, it was still the best art around at the time, just about. So,
The colors where they're drilling into Colomax prison, those pages are really cool with the color explosion coming out of the oil derrick and all. And, I'm thinking Andy must have thought, well, if John's not going to let me color these other pages in, I'm going to really make the full use of colors other places in this issue.
Yeah, I got to go crazy on this one. Yeah,
because, the pages where, the prison is breached kind of thing, and then the explosion and the subsequent reveal, those are very colorful pages to me. Yeah. I mean, that's what leapt out at me. And I'll be honest, I hadn't read this issue since the 80s. So, going through it and getting to these white pages, it was like the best gag of a thing that I'd ever seen. I was like, this is brilliant. Of course, this is Snowblind. Mm-hmm. I loved every second of it, to be honest.
Yeah, it's good, yeah.
Well, I think sorry, Nedra, go ahead.
So I was just going to say, and then the backup feature with the second half of the Shaman origin, if you like.
Yeah.
It reminded me of, Star Wars, with Luke and Yoda, when the ghost of his grandfather appears and starts running him through the what he's got to learn to do. I could hear him say,
So I think this story
gets. This is why you fail.
I think this story gets. If you just heard about it, this is infamous for the white pages. You would think that before you've actually saw the issue, that it's the whole issue is white pages. There's like five pages in here that are white, so it's not even the majority. It's maybe not even 20% of the story is white, and even then you've got sound effects, you've got dialogue, you've got thought bubbles. It's not blank, so exactly. I think it's unfairly slagged on.
You can still follow the story.
A lot. Transition back to the color, after the landslide and the whiteout kind of fades away, because it's those two pages that are facing, and those panels are stretched across both pages. Is just really very evocative. It's like, oh my goodness, this is fantastic.
Yeah, it kind of gives you that, we're coming out of the snowstorm.
And I have to chuckle when I got to the pulling the pine needles out of the medicine bag. My brain went back to an American television show called Northern Exposure, and our film student friend Ed Chigliak was being trained to be the medicine man, and part of his test for that was to bury his hand in the earth. And when he, after, you know, 4 days of his vision quest there, he pulls his hand out and he had pine needles in his hand. And so seeing it here was like, oh, wow. And so, you know, my brain just went there. It was really kind of funny to see something so similar.
I love Northern Exposure. And I did not make that connection.
Yeah.
That came out in what, 1990, so several years later.
It could have been.
But that might just be Canadian shaman lore. So for all we know.
Yeah. Well, this is where we first get the first warning about don't look in the bag, and that will later come into play with another character. When they, you know, it's like it's like, what is it in Ghostbusters? Yeah. Says don't look at the
don't
at the trap.
The streams.
Or he says don't look at the trap. He goes, I looked in the trap, right?
Trap, right? Yeah. Fred, did you have much more to?
Honestly, I mean, I kind of said all I mean, I loved this. I liked the gag. I was looking at, you know, what other things came out during this month, and I had to chuckle. I didn't understand the assistant editor tag until you guys all were talking about it, but they had a special team up this month. Marvel did. And it wasn't a burn team up, because I can't imagine he would have come up with this idea. But the special team up for this month was Aunt May, Franklin, Richard, Franklin. And Galactus.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
She's the Goldie Oldie.
That is one of my favorite Assistant Editor's Month stories ever. Mike Carlin wrote that, and it's just, that's great. Yeah.
But it was also the first issue of a series that I did enjoy. It was a very limited run series. It was the Jack of Hearts. The first issue came out this month.
Mm. Okay, I got to tell you, that series really ticked me off. So Bill Mantlo was the writer, and Bill Mantlo had created the character, I believe her name was Marcy Kane, in Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man. Yeah. Mm. And she had been one of the cast of characters in that story all along, and had normal human troubles, human issues. She even had a point there where she was wearing like a skull cap or something, because she'd been bleaching her hair so much that her hair fell out. And so she was always wearing wigs or bands or stuff like that. And one of the guys in there pulled a prank on her, getting rid of it. And then here comes this book where, boom, all of a sudden, she's an alien. You know, they're watching the Jack of Hearts. And while I like the Jack of Hearts story, that retcon right there really ticked me off, because I liked that character and I liked her in the Peter Parker books. Yeah. And after this point, she gone, you know? Yeah. So,
Well, if you look at the, I'm on Mike's Amazing World, and if you look at the newsstand for everything that came out the same month, this Alpha Flight 6 did, not everything that was from Marvel had the assistant editor's stamp on it. Now, it might have been like this one, the story inside was, but not all of them have it on the cover, and it's not obvious. Like, this is the Amazing Spider-Man has the kid who collected Spider-Man, which is an infamous, not infamous, that's but one it's a famous story.
That's
stories.
A good one as well.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite stories of all time.
Yeah, yeah, the kid that collected Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Well, Marvel did this once before, and I don't know if it was before or after this, but they did a series where all the covers were actual photographs.
Mm. Yeah. We talked about that before, because everybody remembers the Spider-Man cover where he's getting
Peter Parker
caught and changing into Spider-Man, and then the Mask of Doom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I don't remember the other ones.
No, I don't, because that wasn't collecting the other stuff, so I don't know. I don't remember.
But no,
that
I was don't a Doom story. Rivers.
I mean, that was a Burn story with the mask.
Yeah. Ooh. See, I remember there was like 1 month where all of them had the checkerboard pattern on the top like they used to do in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happened to be, I think that was DC. The one where the Avengers wound up on the Tonight Show.
Yeah, with Johnny Carson. That was
Well, they
rubbish.
Did the other ones where they had all the characters around the border, and it was a close-up of a character's face.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah,
that was also happening during the Mutant Massacre.
Mm.
Woo, crazy, crazy stuff.
Mm.
Now, I heard you mention Bill Mantello's name.
Yeah.
Now, didn't he take over Alpha Flight?
Yeah, and actually, go back to page 2. because that guy there, that's her friend, but in that second panel, he looks like Bill Mantlo.
Oh, does he?
Some of the pictures I'd seen of him where his hair was shorter.
Doug.
And then the officer there, the commander, whatever his name, chief inspector, whatever, he looks like J. Jonah Jameson, who's been on Atkins or gone to an all carb diet. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it's his older brother.
It's the attitude, isn't it? Yeah, it's like Jonah. I mean,
look in his face in the very first panel.
In the first one,
looks like Jonah.
Yeah, a bit, yeah.
It's just, you know, all the extra...
And the graying temples, you know, literally black and white, you know, kind of.
Just give him a cigar.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, wait, Mitch Roy's got that kind of little Hitler mustache, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And then if you go to the next page where they're, you know, all looking at that, there was the one guy that Tim and I had mentioned looks like Madison Jeffries, but this guy's more native, and his name's Tom. And then there's another guy that looks like Clint Eastwood there on the right side.
I see it.
I think that bowl haircut makes him look like Jeffries.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it's bowl haircut, definitely. and then the other thing that I noticed in this, now, the previous time that we covered this, when I read it from a digital copy of a scan. And my initial reading was actually from, you know, an actual copy of it. And in both cases, I thought that the art kind of got hurt by it, that it was a little muddy and whatnot. So I had bought off of Amazon the Kindle copy of Alpha Flight Classics Volume 1. Actually, I bought all of them. And reading the digital version of it, my opinion of the art is changed an awful lot. It looks so much better.
Mm-hmm.
In this, you know, format,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then it did in the original print, and that's just, I guess, because of the cheap way that they were printing the books back then.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed it much better this time looking at it like that. One of the things that I found out, I went and did as I usually try to do, some deep dig research. And I found a couple things, like, you know, whose idea was Assistant Editor's Month? Well, that was Jim Shooter's. It was just a marketing ploy that the assistant editors did not take over. They did more work during that month, yes. But everything had to pass the editors and Shooter's word to actually get printed. And then there was, let me see, the sales. The sales on it were the same as usual. Now, there was a funny moment Bernhag connected with that at a Mid-OhioCon where a guy asked him if the pages were blank because he just couldn't think of anything to draw.
Wow.
Yeah. And then, there are a lot of people that thought that he shouldn't have gotten paid for those pages, but Jim Shooter made sure he got paid the standard page rate because that was an artistic choice.
Yeah.
Let me see. What else did I get here? Okay, and we already talked about the light layouts.
While you're looking at it, Brian, we've done Tutu Freaks has done some assistant editor stunts.
Yes.
A couple times.
Where we let the younger guys take over for an episode or so.
We've done that ourselves.
Now the other thing that we didn't really talk about was that when he does recognize her, you can see part of her actual face there.
Yeah.
And it reminds me a little bit of that Nagari demon page 8. The way the skin is on that side of the face. You have to look.
The left side of her face is,
to me, just trying to make her face seem more ethereal, more like something that doesn't have a true form. And he's trying to look past her. As to who she really is, you know, something that is, as Lovecraft would describe, as something that cannot be described.
Okay. And then the last thing that I found in my research, well, actually, I got two items. Number one, I re-listened to our recording of the old one. And somehow back then when I was looking around, I found that all the people that had reviewed Wonder Woman 1984 thought it was great, even better than the first one. And I'm just wondering what the hell they were smoking. And then the last bit was something that just surprised me. I found it today, and the serendipity of this is just really, really weird. At the same time that this issue was produced and put out, a book was produced and put out called The Snowblind Moon by writer John Byrne Cook. No relation whatsoever to Mr. Byrne here. This guy, John Byrne Cook, is actually the son of Alistair Cook, for anybody that's familiar with Masterpiece Theater. Any of y'all remember that?
Yeah, he was the host. Public... He was the host,
right? Yeah. This guy's his son. John Byrne Cook was his son. And not only was he a writer, he was the road manager for Janis Joplin in the 60s up until her death in 70. He was a musician, a photographer, and even made documentary films. And this was a Western that he wrote. He wrote like 5 different Western books. This one was like 860 pages. But I just think it's such a strange, weird, odd coincidence that two guys named John Byrne would put out a story with Snowblind in the title at roughly the same time. The comic came out in October. The book was actually published in January of 84, which means, of course, he'd been working on it for the year before. So it's like roughly the same time Byrne's working on his comic. This guy's working on a novel. And I actually asked Byrne about this. I said, were you aware of this? And he was like, no, he wasn't even aware of it at all. So it's just a weird sort of serendipity.
The universe works in weird ways.
You can play your Twilight Zone theme at any time now.
Yep. We do. We also get, and I know we mentioned it last episode, that we get another comment about Snowbird worrying about succumbing to the bloodlust. She stays in her animal form too long. She mentions this, so she's the bear. So she has to change back into a human form, which I don't know. Because I didn't read later on if that ever keeps reappearing or if that's kind of something forgotten after Byrne left.
Oh, I think that, yeah. Some things she did. Yeah, sorry.
You know, the thing is right around the time John Byrne left, they kind of get rid of like the magical element of Alpha Flight. You know, right around the time Byrne's leaving, Shaman's gone, Snowbird's not around as much. Some of the, you know, there's a kind of a change in the cast of characters a little bit for Alpha Flight right around that point. And I don't want to say too much more than that. But yeah, I recently hit that mark in the run. And initially I was like, why did the artwork get so bad all of a sudden? Then I realized, oh wait, John didn't do these.
Yeah. Mike Mignola's art is it's an acquired taste. Yes. especially back then.
They used to, and they don't do it now at all, but we've mentioned this before on shows, that they would, if a new artist is coming on, they would sometimes draw in the old artist's style and slowly convert to their style. So you might read, like you said, Fred, 3 or 4 issues before you realize, hey, wait a minute, this is not my guy. Now it's just an abrupt, it just changes. You know, they don't try to do that anymore. They don't try to ease you into a new guy or girl.
Okay, I'd like to point your attention to page 5. And the second panel is where Anne's basically transforming into Snowbird.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to figure out what that third image of her, I mean, I guess it's her old uniform, her uniform disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
It just looks really, really scratchy in the middle, you know? But I know he's just trying to do some sort of transformation. Yeah.
Her hair is coming up and forming her mask, looks like.
Well, I think those scratches are, you're seeing through that third image, and you're seeing part of her cloak at that point, because it looks like the edge of her, those scratches in her body.
Oh, yeah.
The edge of her cloak.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Or whatever that is.
Oh, okay. I see what you're talking about.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. It's funny, because that cloak makes me think of G-Force or Gatchaman.
かけて飛び出せば科学忍法火の鳥だ飛べ
But it also makes apparent that powder blue just doesn't look good for a superhero costume. And I mean, she's never been one that's been drawn like other female heroes. Other female heroes are drawn to be sexy and drawn to be, you know, whatever. But, you know, she doesn't particularly look super fit or, you know.
She's not Aurora.
No, she's not Aurora, but she's not, you know, I mean, she's not Jean Grey. She's not Sue Storm. She's not, you know, she doesn't have the physical appearance that the rest of them do. And whether that's just because the colors of the costume don't accentuate that, but I'll point you at Destiny from the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, who also wears a powder blue costume. And again, she was a 70-something-year-old woman who's definitely not going to be in, you know, that kind of shape. But in both their cases, either the costume is doing them no favors or they themselves are not doing any favors in that regard. But again, she's supposed to be beyond certain, beyond those things, you know?
I think the most skin Snowbird ever shows is in page one on the title page when you see her bare leg. Otherwise, you never see her not fully clothed. There's the you know, the quick glimpse when the color comes back in, what is that, page 15, where you see her uniform ripped, but the very first thing she does is heals herself and the uniform's back to being in one piece again.
John Byrne shows her fully nude.
Oh, does he?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
something to look forward to.
She'll be like a year old when you see her.
Well, I think the powder blue is just because he doesn't want her to be all white, so he has to give her some color that's reminiscent of snow. Yeah. But I think color. Because she is written as being, she's not human, so she's kind of naive to the ways of human. She fits in as best she can. Mm-hmm. So I don't
she's
think
half
I don't
human, half goddess. Yeah,
right. I don't know if she would feel modesty. I don't know if she would be like, if she was completely naked, if she would think, well, okay, what's wrong with this? It's, you know, I don't know. So I think she's not worrying about trying to show off anything, and that in her costume shows that it's completely covered.
Yeah, I think it's a good point.
It's kind of like a Storm. Remember in the early issues?
Yes.
She felt confined to have to wear clothes because she was so used to just, you know, running around just with a little loincloth or whatever she had.
Yeah.
Yep. Now, the second story, of course, had a lot more backgrounds in it. Not every page, obviously. And I remember before that Tim, you'd made a comment. I think it was his grandfather's image that made you think of Ditko or Ditko's art.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I like that last image on the last page where it's Doctor Strange and the Ancient One.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And that is, of course, is very
it's very reminiscent of Ditko. Well, I wonder if we brought this up, we talked about this first time, why, and maybe you know, Brian, why he chose on these little origin backstories that he's doing, that he's filtering in like the first 12 issues, why he focuses on, like we said, he never gives Puck an origin, never, in one of these. And some are, you know, this is the second part of Shaman's origin. Sasquatch got his five pages and that was it. I think he goes into Aurora a little more, Northstar, I think less. So why he didn't seem to give equal weight to each of the characters when he was giving these backstories.
Well, I think if he were to give Puck a backstory, it'd just be a guy that was born like that and, you know, always in pain and, you know, there's not much more to that than he went through a lot of stuff to be able to become as good a fighter, always having to prove himself and everything.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Bill Mantlo and whoever else followed him screwed that up completely.
Yeah.
You know, just,
I was just going to say, Puck gets his backstory around issue 33 and 34.
I don't want that backstory. I don't want that.
No.
I want a better backstory.
It's a terrible backstory. But it is what it is.
It is, and I think, I don't know if that's ever retconned later.
I'm looking forward to reading farther to find out that it is retconned.
I don't want to say too much more. We're not going to cover it, but still.
Yeah, I know.
But I just wonder if he was showing some favoritism. He created these characters, and he's like, "Well, I like Shaman more. His backstory is more complex. I'm gonna give him some more pages as opposed to, you know, Sasquatch.
I screwed up. I became Sasquatch." I don't think that's the case, because I think that, I think he liked Puck probably more than most of them, and yet wasn't able to give him, you know, that kind of origin in what we saw.
But to your point, because he has no magic powers, mutant powers, maybe he didn't feel he needed to, or he was going to let maybe he wanted to keep him a little mysterious the way they did with Wolverine for so long. You just got glimpses of his backstory of dialogue.
It's not like he was bit by a member of the Lollipop Guild or something like that. He was supposed to have a normal grow up and be a tough guy. And, you know, he's got the cauliflower ear. It shows he's a grappler. He's wrestled. He did all that stuff. And he wasn't supposed to have any kind of magical or, whatever background. So it's hard to sit there. You know, he'd have to sit there and come up with a really mundane story about a guy that was beat down by his father or somebody to make him tough.
He's like,
and his name alone was, you know, people kept asking Byrne, was he named after the Greek character or whatever? And he said, no, he's named after a hockey puck.
The hockey puck, because it's rolling. I've always thought that, yeah.
It is a Canadian superhero team. You would expect an actual hockey puck.
I did want to ask on the Two Youngmen backstory, which is part two. When you talk about, they have little flashbacks of his wife dying and his daughter enraged that he promised he would save her. There's no story or no dialogue about what happened to her. He's been living in, he's basically left his practice. He's living in his cabin for 10 years. But did the daughter go live with relatives?
She went to live with Heather's family.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Okay. I'm trying to think where she went.
Yeah. In the end of the, you know, the bit after the his wife dies, Heather's father says, you know, you got a lot going on. Don't worry about the kid. We'll take care of her, kind of thing. You know, and so she kind of grows up with Heather as an older sister, kind of thing, from that point forward.
That makes sense. They may, when I know she's reintroduced later. We'll talk about it later. I don't remember if anymore is given to that.
It seemed fairly consistent, you know, in the parts that I had read of the series that they remain that element remained consistent. That she always went to live with the McNeil family.
Let's know if CPS came in, got involved, and put her in foster care or something.
Yeah.
Or whatever Canadian version of that is.
Yeah. And obviously they didn't have the issue with a white family raising a native child, which can be somewhat of a problematic in our current world view. So.
Yep. All right. Well, has anybody got anything else to say on this?
No, I think I'm good. I probably said it before, and I read the one.
That's it. Mm-hmm.
I hope Nigel and I added something new to the conversation.
Oh, definitely.
Always.
Definitely. And then there are new angles and new things seen this time through, you know, older eyes, unfortunately.
Not wiser, just older.
Yeah. But I think that pretty much covers it. Now I'll change subjects here a little bit and let you guys know. There's a lot of talk right now about Elswin, and basically Rob Liefeld had gone on at some point recently and stated that it's going to be published, and, you know, it's going to be inked and colored and published and everything. John Byrne himself said that's news to him, but I think he has to be quiet. Maybe he's got an agreement on it. But even Byrne had said almost a year ago that something's coming, but it's probably going to be 26 before it happens. So, I was talking with Joe Rubenstein just a day before yesterday, because I'd found in the Genius of John Byrne, there was another Joe Rubenstein in there talking like he was him. But there's two different profiles. And Joe told me, no, that's me too. And so we talked about that for a moment, but he hasn't been approached. So, you know, it's like I'm wondering if they're if they would be going for an anchor of the day, or you know, if they, you know, just not going to ink it at all and just be able to color it from the stats.
Yeah. Terry Austin.
He could, yeah, Terry Austin's not, you know, I'm sure he's, he'd be happy to. It just depends how much money
Terry Austin wanna... doesn't want to ink any more burnt, and Terry's retired now too. But yeah, well, he just doesn't want to be known as the John Byrne inker, or that's what he'd said the last time someone asked him.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're leaving money on the table if they don't do it. I understand that it's up to Byrne, that he has to, you know, it's up to me ultimately his decision. But
apparently he'd agreed to it in some form. Now, the most likely company to be producing this would be IDW. All right, they could get the license from Marvel. They could get, you know, agreement to do it. But with IDW going through all the troubles thanks to the bankruptcy of Diamond, it really hurts them in a big way, and it could prevent the company from moving forward. But I think they've restructured enough to be able to maintain because they're still in business.
They could put it out as an artist edition and just do the scans and don't ink it.
I would hope if they do that, they do it as three of them. So they do it a year at a time. Mm-hmm. Because just do art, you know, artist editions.
Artist editions.
So do a year at a time or 12 issues at a time. Let's see, there's 32 issues total.
Mm.
And then there's another at least 10 pages of extra stuff that's been pushed out, you know, beyond that. Pages that weren't used and pages that were changed, like Wolverine spanking Kitty.
Well, he would put those would be like included in the back as bonus.
Yeah. Pieces. So there's room enough for like three artist editions. I hope they would do like that. I mean, it'd be expensive, you know, probably $125, $150 per.
Oh, people, those would sell easily, especially if they're oversized the way they do.
Yeah. Well, you know, they also have a paperback version of the artist editions. I know they did that with David Mazzucchelli's Daredevil, the Born Again series, where it's a paperback and it's like $50.
Yeah. I've got a Gil Kane Spider-Man like that.
Yeah. And I mean, if that's how it came out, I'd buy that. And I think your faithful John Byrne fans, I don't know how many there are left, you know, if we're down to 30,000, 20,000, whatever, but there's 11,000 in the Genius of John Byrne group. Byrne Victims, however, has 13,000 members. I knew there was one that had like 20, but anyway, that's I mean, that's, you know, just you don't know what would be there. What would be the faithful number now that we have? Because back in his heyday, he had his faithful 50,000 that would follow him to any book. So you could always guarantee the book would have 50,000 in sales. And then
It would sell. It would sell like crazy. Anymore. It would sell like crazy, I think. I
know, because it's John Byrne X-Men. But wouldn't you like to get a facsimile edition of the issues or whatever you would call that?
Yeah, I think I would. I don't know if I'd want it inked and colored or if I just want the artist edition. I don't.
And do you want it all inked by one inker, or would you like it like changed? You know, one inker each year.
No.
And who would you want to ink it?
Byrne could ink it himself if he wanted to.
I don't think he does. I mean, he actually is providing, as I understand it, providing the last pages to finish out the stories, the storylines that were in there, because he had several pages of stuff that he never published, but he was getting bogged down with the storylines, and he just kind of lost interest in continuing and lost interest in drawing altogether.
I think Carl Kessel.
Oh, I would love that myself. I've been enjoying his inks on his art in Superman so much more than any other inker.
Well, if he hadn't already passed, I'd say Tom Palmer.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people that would not want that.
No, I know, but I don't know why I liked Palm.
Because his inks are so different. They make the art look so different. When he did the inks on X-Men Hidden Years and on Starbrand, people were pretty upset because they're like, we wanted to see John Bernard. And what you got to see looked more like John Buscema, because the inks that he did on a lot of John Buscema's work was basically Tom Palmer drawing over stick figures, because John Buscema would do light pencils or light breakdowns.
Yeah.
And so he's just a very heavy-handed inker. I don't mind it. I like this stuff, but the average Byrne fan wants it to look like John Byrne drew it.
Well, he said he's like Trevor Scott or Doug Hazelwood.
Scott Williams?
Trevor Scott did the all-new Adam for him, and Doug Hazelwood did his Doom Patrol run.
Is Necro still inking? Because he did some on the Demon, Blood of the Demon.
Yeah, and some of that was a little muddy and dark, but I think that fit with the type of story. But it just depends if you want an anchor to. I mean, as an anchor, I think they would not want to just have me. You know, don't ask me to just trace exactly what the artist has done. Then that's the point. What am I doing? I have to add a little bit of myself to it, or whatever I want.
So. Yeah. Do you remember the last issues of Action Comics that Byrne did? And I'm trying to remember who it was that inked him there, because there was a lot of kerfuffle about that because he really changed a lot. You know, the Gail Simone was doing the writing, and it was just Byrne as an art robot. Black Adam story, and I'm trying to remember. Okay, I think I found. No, that's not it.
Well, that's the most ironic thing, is one of my least favorite John Byrne inkers is John Byrne himself. So
yeah, same here. Yeah.
And see, like, I wouldn't mind seeing Jerry Ordway ink it, but not everybody is a big fan of Jerry Ordway's inks on John Byrne.
Mm.
I liked his inks on them, but I'm going to have to go to Mike's Amazing World to figure out what the number on those issues were, because I just
was it the ones in the 800s.
Oh, they're in the 800s.
Yeah, so it's 827 to 835, I think.
Okay, yeah, you're right. There you are. Okay, so yeah, Nelson was the anchor, and I'm trying to remember his name, his full name. I don't think they put it in here. No, they just put him in as Nelson. And I think he lives in this area where I live. So, but anyway, and he's the anchor that he took great liberties with Byrne's work and changed a lot. A lot on the character faces and such. And if you ever got to look at the pencils, you know, he really just like erased over it and did his own. And I mean, in some cases it looks kind of interesting, but it just doesn't look like Byrne.
I mean, he Vinnie Coletted him.
Well, I mean, you know, Vinnie would just outright erase things a lot out. Of stuff on the page and then not put it back in. You know, he just made there less to ink. Vinnie Whereas this guy would just erase it and redraw it completely. And like Superman's face just does not look right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, that's all I got to say about that. Unless somebody else wants to, I just think it'd be a good question to put out there on a poll. Who would you want to ink Elsewhen? I think that'd be an interesting poll. See what everybody else is thinking.
Mm-hmm.
A modern day inker to do it, or would you get someone that's, you know, not quite retired to come and do it, like Joe Rubenstein or Jerry Ordway?
Can we bring Dick Giordano back to life and have him do it?
Well, I'd probably wind up being someone else anyway. But I think Frank McLaughlin's passed away. Boy. Whew.
Well, all right. Brian, do you want to get something, Brian, or Nigel?
I had something else that I wanted to just mention, but I don't know whether do you want me to mention it now or when we get off air. It's to do with the 10th anniversary get together.
Well, let me just go ahead and say this, and then if it's appropriate, you can add on to the end.
Okay.
Yeah. for those of you that are not aware, Third Degree Burns having their 10th anniversary. We're going to be celebrating it the last week of May. In doing that, everybody that is able to is actually coming to Fort Worth, Texas here so that we can get together, have some cookouts, do some a comic shop crawl, and then go to the Dallas Fan Expo, which is happening on the 30th, 31st, and 1st of May and June. And if anybody is going to be in the area, we're going to be at the con. We'd love to see you all out there. We're going to do comic shop crawls on the Tuesday and Wednesday of that week. If y'all want to join us, we'll be posting on Facebook where we're going to be going each day. Love to see you there. Is that something else you want to add to that? Or
No, it's more to do.
I guess we'll pick up after the show then.
Okay, yeah.
But it would be cool to see, you know, I've talked to a lot of my friends that are around here, Mike Carlisle, Steve Rose, and Walt Thompson, and some other people that may want to join us for the comic shop crawl if they are not working that day. And that, of course, is a thing is, you know, while we're all, you know, taking our time to go do this, and like I'm on vacation, and I'm assuming you guys are as well. Not everybody's going to be on vacation that week. Now, the weekend may be easier to arrange. At the Dallas Fan Expo. We just got to figure out a place to meet up with other people, that is. All right. Well, hey, we'd like to know what you guys think about our show. If you'd like to write to us, there's so many ways you can do it. First off, we've got our Facebook page, Third Degree Burn, right there on Facebook. Easy to see, easy to find. If you want to respond to an episode there, or if you're a member of any other group where we post the episode to, you can leave a message on there. We'll respond to it as well. We also, of course, have an email address. It's gottagetburned@gmail.com. That's gottagetburned@gmail.com. And, of course, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, formerly iTunes, where it'd be great if you'd just leave us a nice 5-star review. We can always use that. It gives us exposure so other people can find us. I think that covers everything. What do you guys think?
Pretty much.
That's pretty much it.
Yep. Alrighty. Well, for Third Degree Burn, you've got Nigel Spake. Say goodbye, Nigel.
Goodbye.
Tim Elliott. Say goodnight, Tim.
Good night.
And Fred West.
That is good night.
Friend. Not East. I'm always going to goof that up, you know. No. And for the rest of everybody else that did not get to make it today, David and John and Kirk, I'm Brian Hughes, and this has been Third Degree Burn. Y'all have a great week.
Don't look directly into the trap.
I looked at the trap, Ray.
Good day.
Good day.
Thanks for listening. You can find us and many other great shows at tutufreaks.com. That's tutufreaks.com. Third Degree Burn is spelled with the number 3, RDDEGREEBYRNE, and is part of the 22 Freaks network of shows. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for Third Degree Burn, spelled with the number 3, and Burn spelled BYRNE. Compliments, complaints, and recipes can be sent to gottagetburned@gmail.com. That's gottagetburned@gmail.com. Drop us a line and tell us how we're doing. Till next time, this has been Third Degree Burn.
Some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn.